This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Martin, kicking things off. Dear Barge Pole and Gangle Sprocket, the seismograph has been going potty. The urchins are cowering in the drains once more and refusing their groats. The dogs are howling and old Seth has put his spare leg in the window. It can only mean that Mount Kermode is rumbling. What could have precipitated this? I suspect Gamer may be the cause. It has thus far garnered some pretty damning reviews, with Kermode-esque, commodular, Kermodian levels of ranting and spouting from many, which once again sets me wondering. OK, the film probably is a worthless piece of dreck and a pustule on the rump of the
Have another run at that, go on.
Arts world. But let us look at the target market, which is, I assume, tween-age boys who spend hours joined umbilically to their consoles, not middle-aged sniffy film critics. It could indeed be argued that it is cruel to subject such delicate petals as the Good Doctor to films of this nature and instead send a couple of leather-sensibilitated youths to give us their opinion. Mind you, it's all right in it. Might have to be padded out a bit to form a decent review. But that is certainly one, and people will make assumptions. We'll get to it after three, yeah. I think. Maybe people might make assumptions because it's all about computer games.
I was a leather... What was the phrase? Leather-clad...
A leather-sensibilitated youth.
Leather-sensibilitated?
Yes. If you have the sensibilities of... leather.
Oh, I see. Not as in wearing leather like Elvis in the 1968 comeback special.
Which, who knows?
Okay, fine. Which, incidentally, still is one of the greatest TV musical performances of all time, and I have yet to see Jay-Z top that.
So we'll do Gamer, Away We Go, and Blind Dating, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 3D, The Firm, 3 Miles of Malcolm. We probably won't get...
Miles of Malcolm?
Yes.
3 miles north of Malcolm.
Well, what we'll do is we'll probably just do Gamer, and then that'll be it, and we'll have run out.
We won't. And can I just say, incidentally, in advance, it's always dangerous waters to just anticipate that I just go off on one if I don't like a film. There's a difference between not liking a film and a film actually making you angry, and or a film sort of being just so bland that it becomes apoplectic. And I would like to state for the record that it's not necessarily the case that just because I don't like a film, I go off on one. I'm trying very hard, increasingly hard. I'm trying, still trying, still very trying hard to be measured.
Why? People don't tune into this feature, if indeed they do.
This feature?
To have measured opinion. Yes, you're a feature in a broader show. On the subject of which, by the way, the broader show will be finishing, as we mentioned, at the end of this year. But this particular part of it will be continuing forever.
Yeah.
And there's a very interesting film on your blog.
Yeah, about just how... Because the thing is, obviously, you know, you wouldn't do anything at all to move this particular feast. Because No. Well, that's what you said. So there's a little film of you and me celebrating the fact that...
And I can see that at Kermode Uncut.
Yeah, BBC/Mark Kermode. And then you can see how happy you are to know that you haven't got rid of me yet.
Let's do a box office top 10, see where we go, and we'll be... building up to these new releases. Now, number 10 is Adventureland. Here's an email from Nick, who's in New Jersey.
Yes.
Mark and Simon.
New Jersey.
Indeed, New Jersey it is. I am a loyal fan of the film reviews and have agreed with just about every piece of criticism and praise he has given in the 2 years that I've been listening via podcast.
Oh dear, that's a very bad precedent.
He has rarely steered me wrong, and I've come to depend on his good taste and judgment to govern what films I see. As I listen to the latest batch of reviews, I'm also trying to pass a very stubborn kidney stone and have taken some powerful pain medication. Please tell me that the OxyContin high that I'm on has something to do with my distorted sense of reality, but I think I just heard Mark give a positive review to the boring, self-indulgent, whiny, head-up-its-own-bottom waste of what seemed like 10 hours of my life mess that is Adventureland. I had the misfortune of seeing this film with my brother-in-law. About 20 minutes in, I wanted to leave or scream, but did neither, thinking that perhaps my companion was somehow enjoying it. As soon as it was over, we both looked at each other and agreed that it was the worst movie we had ever seen. Thanks, Terry. And we've both seen Transformers. I'm off to try and pass the kidney stone now, and this will be infinitely more pleasurable than watching Adventureland.
Right, the thing I say to everybody who says, "See that? That's the worst movie I've ever seen." Right, it doesn't matter where they come from. That's the voice that they use. See that? That's the worst. No.
So they talk in New Jersey.
No. Come to my house, and I will show you oversexed rug suckers from Mars. That is the worst film you will ever see. It's not the worst film ever made, because clearly that's The Heretic, but it's the worst
but
film...
But given that we don't have access to that, most normal people do not have access to that, this is out it's, there, it's yeah, at no, number it's, 10.
What can I say? You're completely wrong. I know it was funny, because Charlie Fink was in last week from Noah and the Whale, and he was surprised... It was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Seems like such a long time ago, what with all that breath-holding. And he was in, and he was kind of surprised that I liked it as well. And I'm kind of surprised that everyone's so surprised. It reminded me of... I mean, some people have compared it to John Hughes, which I think is a dangerous comparison to make. It reminded me of that 1970s movie, Jeremy, which I mentioned before. I think there's something about it which is very different to all the incredibly laddie, incredibly, you know, male-orientated blokes talking about women in foul ways, adolescent comedies that we're now saddled with. I mean, it's funny. I almost feel nostalgic for the sensitivity of films like Porky's nowadays, or Lemon Popsicle. Lemon Popsicle now looks like some kind of incredibly Ibsen-like drama about... you know, proper human emotions. Frankly, I thought Adventureland was lovely, and I would happily go and see it again, and I would suggest, I think the word you were struggling for there was oxytocin, wasn't it?
Oh, I'll put it
I think it was
here.
Anyway, but whatever you were under the influence of when you saw the film, it may just have been a cloudy bad mood, I would advise you go and see it again, because I thought it was very touching, very tender, very funny, and a big change from the kind of adolescent nonsense that we've been saddled with in the last few years.
Well, it's spelled OXYCONTIN. That's why I said OxyContin. But
oh, well, that's probably what it is in that case. I don't really think of oxytocin. But oxytocin is the thing that they give you in childbirth.
Well, I'm sure someone with a medical qualification will explain to us what is the medication that you're given if you're trying to pass a kidney stone. Mm.
What's the medication that you're given that makes a really good, smart, adolescent coming-of-age love story look like a really bad, boring movie that's worse than Transformers?
Funny People's at 9.
Haven't seen it.
Aliens, you really, really, really need to.
I know, but I see. What I keep figuring is if I wait long enough, it'll go out of the top 10 and just go away.
Yes,
normally, I have to grab these. But also, my defence is that every week since I've been back, there've been 9 films out. So you have a choice. This morning, I could have gone to have seen that, or I could have gone to see Gamer, which we're going to get a review of, or I could have caught up with Miss March, which I have to see now because several people have assured me that it is, in inverted commas, the worst film ever made.
Okay, I want to get to the bottom 5 of this top 10. Before the news, so let's see what we do.
You're going to be lucky.
At 9, Aliens in the Attic at 8.
It's all right, but nothing more than that.
Glorious at 7.
Yeah, we've been ran in Glorious.
Now, number 6, Julie and Julia. So, yeah. A whole bunch of emails on this. Nick, very long one, but part of it says, Dear Mork and Mindy, my main concern about this film is that the Amy Adams character spends a year cooking and eating rich food with a heavy emphasis on butter, yet she does not gain any weight
exactly.
at all. At
exactly.
one point, she refers to herself getting fat, which got the biggest laugh of the night, as quite clearly she wasn't. Surely any decent director would have had Ms. Adams put on weight for this role, as Renée Zellweger did for the Bridget Jones movie, or just got an actress more suited to the role. My fiancé, meanwhile, enjoyed the film, but felt it didn't quite live up to the book. Tim Wilson in New York.
The books. It's based on 2 books.
Feel free to correct the listener. Dear Huey and Dewey, I was a bit disappointed at your attitude to last week's Muriel Strepsil's vocal impersonation of American cooking celebrity Julia Child in Julie and Julia. She absolutely nails Child's florid vocal inflections.
Who lives here?
Cartoonish as it may have sounded to you, I like to think that Michael Sheen's performance as the uniquely over-the-top Kenneth Williams wouldn't be unfairly judged over here, simply because Williams is totally unfamiliar to American audiences. This is not a cue for you to do impressions. It's Friday afternoon and there's a lot of films to discuss. We're halfway through the box office top 10. You're looking at me as though there's something important to say.
Can I tell you two Elvis-related things to do with films? Which are...
Do you have to?
Well, just because that's... The news story keeps coming up, like some taunting horror. You've said it once now. Can we not keep saying
it? It's provoking quite a big reaction, therefore I feel I must keep telling
people. Okay, fine.
Just because it's gone out once doesn't mean that you don't sort of stop repeating a story.
Is that not how it works?
Because apparently, people tune in at different times.
Oh, okay. Can I tell you these two bits of Elvis-related movie trivia which are important?
I think we'll be the judge of that.
Okay, they'll be quick. The first one is that Elvis was offered the role that Chris Christopherson took in A Star Is Born. And, of course, Elvis always saw himself as a proper actor. He sort of admired Marlon Brando and James Dean, and he never wanted to end up doing all those really stupid movies that the Colonel, made him do. And before he went into the army, he actually did do some decent acting work. And when he came out, this was he was sort of locked into this horrible contract, but he wanted to play the Chris Christopherson role in the remake of A Star Is Born, and he didn't end up doing it because his manager, Colonel Tom, said, no, you cannot take second billing to Barbra Streisand, and therefore he wasn't allowed to do it. So the great thing that he was never allowed to do didn't happen. And the second one is that Gail Brewer Giorgio, who wrote those two books, Is Elvis Alive and The Elvis Files, had this theory that after Elvis was meant to have died, there was an Elvis impersonator called Orion, who apparently was really, really good, and some people thought that Orion really was Elvis. And she believed that Elvis had faked his own death, come back to perform gigs as an Elvis impersonator called Orion, and then set up Orion Pictures, who then went on to win the Best Film Oscar with Silence of the Lambs, which means that in a certain alternative universe, Elvis did finally win the Oscar he always so dearly wanted.
Can you ask the good matron the name of the film where Elvis is not dead and is in a sort of care home where a sort of evil creature wreaks havoc with the residents?
Very, you know, it's a Bruce Campbell movie. It's a Bruce Campbell movie, yeah. It's called a Bubba Hotep, and Bruce Campbell plays, well, there's two characters. One of them says that they're John F. Kennedy, and the other one says that Bruce Campbell plays the Elvis figure. And they are visited by Bubba Hotep, who is a mythical beast-like creature. And
he's
they
in
have
the mummy,
fight.
Isn't he?
Yeah, sort of mummy. And it's very, actually, what's interesting about that film is that although it could be played entirely for goofy sort of splatter laughs, it does have a poignancy about it. And when Bruce Campbell came in on the show, I think one of our most hallowed guests, in fact, he was lovely because, of course, he's clearly a big Elvis fan, and he clearly played that role, you know, very seriously.
And that was Paul in Belfast.
Thank you to Paul in Belfast.
Matthew, Simon, while I wouldn't deny Elvis a certain emotional power, to me he is a collection of vocal tics and mannerisms that will not exactly disappear in the world's consciousness, but certainly recede. Whilst Jay-Z is a great creative genius, a poet, a conjurer of urban visions, a New York musical phenomenon in the musician-poet line of Armstrong, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and so on, Elvis looks like a cartoon to me, with the passing of time, a curiosity, and as has been pointed out, was simply an interpreter of other people's visions.
Well, you know, all I can say is go back and listen to the original, you know, trio recordings with the three of them effectively I mean, the honest truth of it is that the stuff that was done before they brought in a drummer was exceptional, and I defy anyone to say that those original recordings with just a, you know, stand-up bass guitar and acoustic guitar weren't every bit as radical and transformative as the most avant-garde jazz, which I hate, incidentally.
And MK on this, I think it's MK, anyway, saying, if the question is Jay-Z or Presley, the answer is Bob Dylan. So the top five has 500 Days of Summer. Stop. 500 Days of Summer.
Okay.
At number five, Dear Doyle and Russo. This is... well, it's signed Edgar Davids. Long-time listener, first-time emailer. Mm. Didn't have anything better to do. Bit bored. Thought I'd go down to my local multiplex. And I watched 500 Days of Summer, or 500 Days of Puke, as I now like to call it. That's not bad. So that's the kind of thing my nine-year-old
would say. That's good. Can we call it that?
Where does one start? Let me just give you a few highlights. Zoo Animal Deschanel made me want to punch the screen every time she appeared, which is a shame, as I thought she was good in All the Real Girls, which is a much better film.
Yeah.
Two, the whole postmodern love story angle smacks of huge pretension when the film is clearly merely nothing better than a two-hour episode of Dawson's Creek chopped up and thrown together in a random sequence. Three, I agree with the good doctor, the use of the Smiths in the soundtrack to this film is egregious. Egregious indeed, and wince-inducing. Four, what on earth is that song and dance routine in the middle all about? Five, at best this movie was horribly cliched, and at worst it is vain, pathetic and ill-conceived. There's so much more, but anyway, that's the kind of highlight. Right. And Craig on this, 500 Days had great moments, a great soundtrack and an annoying lead female character.
Oh, Zooey.
No, I mean, I agree with all of that. It didn't quite annoy me quite as much as that particular email, but I think that the whole sense of it being totally self-obsessed and narcissistic and navel-gazing in that kind of emo-y way is absolutely the problem with it, because you do want to go, oh, shut up. Just, you know, what's that thing that... you know, pull your trousers up, turn your hat round, and get a proper job.
What school did you go to?
Well, that's not a school. That's what's his name who wrote All the Trouble in the World?
Yeah. Sorority Rose at number four.
Which is not without fleeting moments of enjoyment amidst all the ridiculous, you know, pulchritudinous, leery remake nonsense. There are a couple of...
Because pulchritudinous is very good.
It is.
Like that.
It's you know, you take an old slasher movie, you sort of update it, you do something vaguely modern with the dialogue, but you still populate it with, you know, people running around in their underwear. And this is all the remnants of the post-I-know-what-you-did-last-summer wave. Steve, when after Scream, suddenly everybody went, oh, yeah, it was postmodern, now it's OK, it's all fine again. So we are sort of back where we started there. But I'd like to be able to tell you that the Sorority Row is completely without merit, but it isn't. There are a couple of bits in it that are passingly, sneeringly funny, but it is rubbish.
Dorian Gray's at three.
It's not the best adaptation of Dorian Gray by quite a long way. I think the main, I think there are things in it that are worthwhile. I think Colin Firth does a pretty good job, and in fact, I it's worth seeing just for him. The real kind of the thing which epitomises everything that's wrong with it is that they've decided that the way to go with the painting is to do the painting as a kind of graphic, maggoty, moving thing. Whereas, in fact, if you look at previous adaptations in which a painting has literally been an oil painting, there's much more soul-shaking horror. Plus, the sense of his descent into depravity. It's just not depraved enough. I mean, I know they reined it in for a classification thing, but if somebody's really going to go to the pit of depravity, it's not really enough to have them go to a club where some people are dancing around like members of Hot Gossip. You know, it's not that depraved, really.
The Final Destination at two.
In 3D, and I haven't been it. I haven't seen it.
And I don't think you're going to like it.
Well, I don't know.
You
I
mean, can't judge it, of course, on the
No,
poster.
Can't judge it, and haven't seen it, so wouldn't think of passing judgment on it. Anyone seen it, let us know.
Michael Woolwick in Bolton on the number one movie, which is District 9. Dear Pinky and the Brain, I have just got home from the cinema and have seen possibly the best film to be released this year.
Yeah, a couple of people have said that.
District 9 is billed as a sci-fi film. However, it is so much more. The musical score... so atmospheric, it was hardly much of a musical score. Anyway. And the acting was out of this world, especially the turn by Sholto Copley. He conveyed a wide variety of emotions and managed to cultivate an amazing relationship with the lead alien and his son.
There is he the main guy, the guy who plays Vicky's van der Meer? Is that
yes,
him?
Yeah, yes. There was a real sense of bond, friendship and such believability about their relationship in the film in its entirety. The film is so emotionally and physically tense. I was glued to the screen with every sinew in my body. One of the most important aspects of the film was its ability to tell the story with real emotion and intensity without going down the AVP route.
Alien vs. Predator, sorry.
Presumably.
Yeah, yeah.
There also has to be a huge pile of praise placed on these SFX people behind the film as they produced a masterpiece with such a tiny budget. I hope this film goes on to win the awards it so richly deserves.
It has been warmly embraced. I still think there's an awful lot of Peter Jackson all over it. I mean, obviously, he's the kind of, you know, producing thing behind it, but there is a sensibility about it which reminds me of Bad Taste, to some extent, of Brain Dead. Obviously, it also refers to things like Cronenberg's The Fly. It refers to John Carpenter movies. It's a very cine-literate film. I mean, I just enjoyed it, and it is like all the best sci-fi, not to be taken literally, but to be taken allegorically. I mean, obviously, the allegory is written pretty sort of bold. I know we did this before, the difference between allegory and parable, and I always get it wrong, don't I? No, it is allegory that I mean rather than parabolic. It is both allegorical and probably hyperbolical and parabolical at the same time.
When you use the word pulchritudinous, how were you meaning that to apply to this?
Well,
film?
I take pulchritudinous to mean, buoyant and I can't think of a polite way of saying it. Perky.
Yes.
Handsomely endowed.
Pull care, meaning beautiful, loveliness, beauteousness, and fairness.
Yes. Pulchritudinous.
It was just worth.
Sorry, I thought you were going to turn out that in fact it was a word that meant something completely different.
Vile and horrendous.
Yeah, in the same way that the word that I kept using that I got corrected on before, which was not Stygian, something to do with hellish. And we got corrected by a vicar.
Tom in Manchester, because it's Jay-Z versus Elvis, but he wants to say it's the 39th anniversary of the death of Jimi Hendrix today, and on behalf of all his followers, please announce that, because Elvis never wrote a song and Jay-Z is mass-produced nonsense. And Russell say there's a difference
between
Jay-Z
and Elvis.
Not
true that Elvis never wrote a song, incidentally.
Jay-Z took control of his own destiny, whereas Elvis was a finger puppet. Now, we need to stop that, because you're going to start walking out on the show.
No, it's okay, it's fine. I've calmed down an awful lot since the Radcliffe storming out. Elvis was not a finger puppet, it was a different period of time. People have learnt lessons as a result of what happened to Elvis. It doesn't help when you are being managed by somebody who essentially was a carnival huckster who laid out his table by, you know, virtually doing chickens dancing on a hot biscuit tin routine. That was what he was saddled with.
So there you go. We got to 18 minutes past three. Not a single movie reviewed.
But we've covered a lot of issues.
We have covered a lot of issues, and they were all issues that needed to be discussed.
They are.
Take it away with something brand new.
So, Gamer, and I'm telling you right at the beginning of this that we don't have a clip from this, and I paid to go and see it because they didn't seem to be very keen to show it to the critics.
And that's usually a very bad sign.
Well, It's an increasing sign. I mean, it's a mistake to believe, and I'm not saying there weren't, it's possible there may have been some screen. I can't find any reviews of it anywhere else, and the Time Out review comes from Time Out in New York, so I'm assuming it wasn't. I certainly wasn't invited to a screening, so I just went down the way to go and pay and go and see it now, and I just sat in the cinema and watched it with four other paying customers, so there are at least four people who have paid to see it, and it'll probably do all right at the box office. So, the story is Gerard Butler. Probably most famous for "This is Sparta!" Him, right? You know, oiled.
Yes.
Why are we looking baffled when I did that?
Well, just for a moment, I couldn't work out what the accent was, because it sounded as though it was going to be Scottish.
Well, it's
just
Gerard Butler, isn't it? This is Sparta!
Well, that's a little bit of Ian Paisley, so then I was getting...
No! Sparta says no!
There. Okay. Anyway, I don't think it's going to be anything to do with the Northern Ireland peace process, the DUP, or anything
like
that.
No, although, as we said, all science fiction is politically allegorical, and if you wish to see more in it, then that's absolutely fine. So the story is Gerard Butler's brain has been replaced by some effectively new gizmo, which enables him to be played as a computer game. It's in the future, OK? And somebody has discovered a way of putting a thing into your brain which turns you into a real-life sim. You know what a sim is?
Yes.
I didn't, but apparently...
You surprised me not at all.
No, fine. Sims, OK? Apparently people play these games in which they have other lives, simulated lives.
And you can build up a whole family.
Can you? Why would you want to do that? Why don't you just have a proper family?
Well, because you're nine.
Oh, OK, fine. Fair enough.
And what they do, it's a great bit, which they discover very, very early on, that it's possible that you get your mother figure and your father figure and you have children, then you build a swimming pool and then they go for a swim. And then you can change the design of the swimming pool so that they keep on swimming up and down until they get exhausted and die.
And are you serious?
And that's quite entertaining, isn't it?
Is this
in the world of Sims?
In the real world, this really happens.
No.
In the Sims, no. But in the real world, this Sims game that you're talking about,
yes,
really, yeah, fine.
You can do that. Anyway, I hope Gerard
suddenly
Butler
gamer
makes more fun
seems
with it.
You know less fantastical by every minute. Anyway, so the story is: so they get this thing put inside them, and then they can be played. Okay, and there's an original that starts off that the game is a sort of a simulated but not simulated, and then it turns into a game called Slayer, in which you can play a character that goes around shooting other people. And there's a thing. This is all set up in the first 5 minutes. Essentially, people on death row have the chance to be one of the players, and the chances are they won't survive. But if they do, then they get out to be set out free. Gerard Butler is one of the people. He's been put in prison on a false charge, never fully explained, and he's out there slaying, and he now has only a few more games to get through slaying, and once he's done all the slaying, then he may be free, and then he can go and get his wife and child back. And like everyone in these movies, when they do the flashback, everyone who's wrongly in prison seems to have spent some time in a field, a sort of autumnal field, with a nice shirt on, playing jolly games with their child and wife in beautiful sunshine, for which they can have a flashback. It's almost like you cannot be wrongly accused and put in prison unless at some point in your life you had this particular Timotei commercial happen in your life. It's very odd. They never have flashbacks of their life in which their lives... This is always the flashback they have. It's a field and there's a tree and they're sitting back and they've got a shirt on, it's slightly open and everything's very relaxed and a child is running around through some sunlight and it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. If you don't have that experience, you can obviously not get wrongly convicted. Anyway, so he's running around shooting people.
An interesting history lesson.
Yeah, but
Thank you for that.
Watch it. It's something that happens time and time again. Anyway, he's running around shooting people. He is being... operated by a computer geeky nerd sitting at home, and a lot of shooting ensues. Now, in order to do the film justice, of course, one should refer to the BBFC website, because in a way they do this sort of more unemotionally than I do. So, gamer, we were talking about for the tweenage audience, rated 18 for strong bloody violence and sexualized nudity. And the BBFC's report points to near relentless focus on gun violence, strong moments of realistic and bloody violence. So the impact is aggravated by the fact that it's the hero with whom viewers will identify. That's Gerard Butler! This is Sparta! Who is using the violence as a means of resolving all disputes and challenges. All disputes and challenges resolved by violence. Strong sexualized nudity, images of bloody, bloody, blah. Brief images of performers swinging on hooks embedded in their skin. It goes on and on and on. So, here's the question. How can a movie with all this, and don't get me wrong, because I have always, in the past, been a fan of exploitation movies, exploding helicopters, gratuitous violence. It was funny, Kevin Spacey was on that time, we were doing the top 10, and I said that my problem with the remake of Death Race 2000 was it didn't have enough gratuitous violence. He said, well, I don't like gratuitous violence in movies, which is frankly rich, coming from somebody who's made some of the movies that he's made. But, if you're going to make a gratuitously violent movie, that I don't have a problem with that. That's fine. Exploitation cinema, fine. It was kind of where I grew up. That's not a problem. What is a problem is that Gamer is so thuddingly dull that even with all the gratuitous sleaze that's on screen and which is detailed there in the censor's report, it's very, very hard to concentrate on the screen and to frankly stay awake, even in the sort of early morning. Because I saw this thing started at 12 o'clock. That's, I know it's not early morning, middle of the day as opposed to the evening. It's directed by those two guys, Neville Dean and Taylor, I imagine they're guys, and who are the people behind the Crank movies. And do you remember when I reviewed the first Crank movie, which was Jason Statham? And I said it's, you know, it's not up there with the Transporter series, because the Transporter series of movies really takes what Jason Statham is and does something good fun with them. And
what is it that he is?
Well, he's basically a sort of homoerotic figure. He is. I mean, that's, you know, and he does all that sort of action movie stuff of smothering himself in oil and wrestling other blokes in oil.
We've all done that.
Yeah, we have all done it. And Jason Statham is very happy to do it in the Transporter movies. And there's a fantastic thing in Transporter 3 in which, you know, he has to do a striptease and he has to do it twice because that's what the film's really all about. And then in the Crank movies, I said the problem is it sort of missed that and it just tipped over into the kind of sort of slightly more leery misogyny that makes a lot of exploitation cinema rather boring. And then in Crank 2, there's that sequence when they run. Remember, Andrew Collins was on the week the Crank 2 came out, and in fact, he walked out of it. The Crank 2 is directed by Neville Dean Taylor, and he walked out of it because he said there was a really appalling scene in a nightclub in which people were shooting
that, yeah.
In a nightclub, and it was, you know, strippers, and there was a, you know, what was meant to be ha-ha funny about silicone blasting everywhere, which wasn't funny at all, was really. Well, frankly, there is an awful lot of that in Gamer. There's an awful lot of stuff on the screen that's just nasty in its prurience, that demonstrates an attitude towards every woman on screen that is really quite yucky and not in any way entertaining, just slightly loathsome, but done in a way which is meant to sort of have the moral high ground. It's saying, oh, look, these horrible people are making all these women do this, and incidentally, let's have a look at it, and let's have another look at it, and let's have a look, another look at it, and incidentally, have you missed that bit? Let's have another look at it. So there's that. So on the one hand, you've got Gerard Butler running around with a massive great gun, shooting this massive great gun at pretty much everything, and then, which is kind of boring. I mean, I imagine that's what playing those shoot 'em up games is just like, you know, and nothing else. And then every now and then, it's like, I'll tell you what it's like. If you were flipping the channels on a television, and on the one hand, there was somebody playing one of those shoot-em-up games, and on the other hand, the next channel up was one of those MTV music stations, which literally just consists of shots of people's, what's the word? Booty.
Bottoms?
Yeah, well, you know, shaking in I suppose what's designed to be a, you know, an arousing, exciting manner, but in fact incredibly depressing, and makes you wonder whether, you know, the 70s didn't happen, and, you know, where's Gloria Steinem when you need her? So it's like that.
How many times do you watch that channel then?
Which channel?
The one with the aforementioned videos with
Well, it's just when you go through the check, that's all it ever is, isn't it? I mean, I don't, because I don't understand the music. I mean, I'm not saying it's not, maybe that music is brilliant, but it's not, you know, it doesn't matter any time of day or night. When you're going up towards CBeebies, which is 70, it doesn't matter what time of day or night, somewhere around 35, there's woola, 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 you know, there's all that going on. It's just, what?
Woola, woola, woola. That's a great channel.
Fine, anyway.
I must look out for that.
So,
is that Jay-Z who does that woola 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 music?
No. Anyway, so what I'm saying is...
Thank you to all the listeners who are saying, can you please say Jay-Z?
Jay-Z.
Just to annoy people.
Yes,
anyway,
Mr. Jay-Z.
Sorry, go on.
So, Gerard does nothing but growl, which he doesn't growl as well as Jason Statham. Not as well as Jason Statham, and he does a lot of shooting. The shooting is incredibly boring. The visual style is like the Crank movies, which was kind of all right once, boring the second time, and terribly boring the third time. It's like, somebody get a tripod. And it makes reference at one point to the martial art movies of Bruce Lee, and that somebody gets struck with three stripes, which, of course, mean that somebody gets three bloody stripes, you're referring to Bruce Lee. And it made me think, you know, the difference between this movie and the Bruce Lee movies is exactly the same as the difference between Chicago and Singing in the Rain. I was talking to Terrence Davis about this the other day. Singing in the Rain, that entire Singing in the Rain sequence is done in something like seven shots, right? Whereas Chicago, every time somebody's foot hits the floor, there's a cut, so you have no idea of the sense of physical performance. Well, in these movies, when Bruce Lee did his movies, it was, you had an incredible sense of somebody doing something really athletic and really brilliant. Really, even if you weren't interested in the story or any of that stuff, you could just watch the physical beauty of Bruce Lee. In these movies now, like Gamer, it's just, there's not even that sense, because it's cut, 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 cut. It's just gun, fire, gun, fire, gun, fire, boom, squib, gun, fire, bang, squib. So, boring.
Woola, woola, woola.
Woola, woola, woola. Yes, and every now and then, channel changing, woola, 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 and then, you know, gunfire, gunfire, woola, 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 gunfire, gunfire, you know, gunfire, and that's it. And then it stops. And so, it's boring with moments of reprehensibility.
That should go on the poster. This is an example of the kind of high-class listener we have. His name is Stephen Dyken, BA, MFA, Film Production, Los Angeles, California. Dear Virtue in the Way. Do you want to be the way?
Okay.
Oh, no, that sounds blasphemous. I don't know what it means, but anyway. Or maybe you want to be Virtue. Although the filmmakers of Gamer tried to create images that would afford visually subtextual commentary on a hypothetical vulgarity which is overcoming society, or an obscene montage of simulacra, which I've looked up, which is Simulacra and Simulation, a Philosophical Treatise by Jean Baudrillard, threatening an equally hypothesized
humanity. Have another run at Baudrillard, go on.
Baudrillard. Jean Baudrillard.
Jason Statham.
Okay.
Baudrillard.
I've lost the flow.
Go on.
Threatening an equally hypothesized humanity, ultimately the attempt is dwarfed by the grotesquely stunted intellect of the film itself. That is, nothing contained within the film is as disturbing or frightening as the thought of the filmmakers encouraging one another that they were constructing something cinematically cogent. In fact, I stepped out of the auditorium during the film to write this, and in the time that it took to write these two sentences, mind you, some sentences... Yes. The warm realisation that I would subsequently leave the cinema washed over me like the relaxed pleasure of voiding one's bladder in the shower. Anyway, he kind of loses it at the end.
No, but he's good and he's bang on. And can I also just say, in terms of, and not original either, because obviously it's basically the same story as The Most Deadly Game, or more recently, Series 7, The Contenders, or to some extent, Battle Royale. It's, I mean, it's a story which we've all heard a million times before, and incidentally has been done on straight-to-video and straight-to-DVD movies for several years. So it's not even original.
Have you read Simulacra and Simulation by Jean Baudrillard?
No, I haven't read any Baudrillard.
I had to look it up because Stephen F. Dyken, BA, MFA, was referring to it in his general argument with Gamer. So
yeah.
I'm going to see if I can get it in a sort of a small version to read over the weekend.
I do know what the plural of octopus is, though.
Octopi?
No, this was on your programme. Our programme.
Oh, this programme.
This programme.
I think you'll find it's my programme and you're a guest on it.
That's why I said your programme, and then you looked shocked. Octopodia, apparently.
Anyway, if you have... is it? Okay, very good.
Well, according to somebody with letters after their name who wrote into the programme to say, it's Octopodia.
If you have read Simulacra and Simulation...
Or if you are Baudrillard...
Or no, Jean Baudrillard. Have you read it, Justine?
I'm afraid not, no. Well, been a bit busy.
In the old days, we wouldn't have employed newsreaders who hadn't read that. But this is clearly dumbing down of the worst kind.
Yeah.
Have you read any philosophical treatises?
I've read a bit of Sartre.
That'll do. Good, well, good. You got
a man who was so stupid he didn't even know he existed.
Mayo at bbc.co.uk, 85058. What is our next movie coming up?
Away We Go.
Away We Go, which is the new Sam Mendes film.
Sam Mendes film, yeah.
Please don't forget the podcast is available. Go to the 5 Live website. I think you can do it via iTunes as well. And here is an intriguing... email from Danny. Dear Blatty and Friedkin, regarding the guy right at the beginning of this feature who thought Adventureland was the worst film he had ever seen,
yeah,
even though Mark liked it.
Yeah.
Follow this. Danny says, it's quite possible for a film Mark liked to be the worst film a listener has ever seen. In fact, it's even quite likely, and here's how. Mark's job is to take a bullet for the rest of us. He sees everything, so we don't have to. So there may well be an ideal listener out there who only goes to see films Mark likes and avoids everything he tells us is rubbish. It then follows quite logically, yep, that the worst film that the listener has ever seen will be the least good of all the films Mark has liked.
Yep. That's true.
And that film might well be Adventureland.
Yeah. But that is
now
also...
That's the most coherently argued email.
Yes, you're not going to hear anything that coherent for the rest of the afternoon, but that does also highlight why it is that I think that it's quite a good idea for everybody every now and then to see a really terrible film. I mean, like a really not like a gamer kind of terrible film, but a really terrible film just to see...
Sex Lives of the Potato Men?
Yeah,
kind of thing.
I mean, that really
bad.
I still think is kind of the low watermark. I mean, it was just so horrible.
And the Simulacra, by the way, thank you for all the correspondence on that. Tim Morton in Leicester. The Simulacra is a 1964 science fiction novel by Philip K. Dick. The novel portrays a future totalitarian society apparently dominated by a matriarch, Nicole Thibodeau.
But that's not Thibodeau. But you said that there was a book called...
The Simulacra and the Simulacrum is something that replaces reality with its representation and was the work of Jean Baudrillard. Thank you. Let's move on because I want to hear some film reviews. Okay. What's next? I'm hoping it's a Sam Mendes film.
Away We Go, which is the new film by Sam Mendes, who, of course, famous. I mean, he started out being a theatre director, then made American Beauty, which went on to win the Oscar for Best Film. It was, you know, it was an extraordinary thing for a first feature. Made Road to Perdition, which was visually very, very arresting, visually very interesting, perhaps not quite as narratively complex as some people might have thought, but I thought it was an interesting piece of work. And then, most recently, Revolutionary Road, which we were talking about in the run-up to the Oscars. Now, in many ways, Away We Go is best understood as sort of the flip side, the antithesis of Revolutionary Road. In Revolutionary Road, you had two characters, right, who were married to each other and stuck in a, you know, lovely house, moaning and whining and complaining. They had this lovely house with lovely shirts and lovely ties and lovely cars, and they did nothing but whinge and say they were going to go to Paris, right? In Away We Go, you have a totally opposite situation in which you have a couple who are very much in love and they very much like each other, but they decide they are going to go on the road, and they do go on the road, and that's what happens during the course of the movie. In the case of Revolutionary Road, everything falls apart, everything's very bitter, everything's very twisted, everything's very closed in. In the case of Away We Go, not the case. So here's the setup. The two central characters played by John Krasinski, who apparently is best known from the American version of The Office, which I've never seen. Have you seen it?
Only in short, you know, like 3 or 4 minute doses. Not
okay,
a proper
was it any good?
All the way through. Well, it was very successful in America, but you kind of think it's difficult to beat Ricky Gervais.
Right? No, sure. Okay, well, him and Maya Rudolph, they are the couple. The script, incidentally, is written by these two people who've been described. This is very funny. They've been described by Dave Eggers and Vendela Vida, who've been described by the San Francisco Chronicle as the literary equivalent of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. I imagine that at the point that comment was made, Angelina Jolie hadn't yet hoved over.
Gone in and spoiled everything.
Gone in and spoiled everything. So anyway, they're a couple. They are pregnant. I mean, obviously, no, they're both pregnant. Although they were caring, sharing couple, so we say they are both pregnant. And they live in what looks like very temporary accommodation, pretty much in the middle of nowhere. Near to them is his parents, and they are assuming that the parents are going to be around to help them look after the baby when it's born. Here's a clip.
Okay, we have news.
It's big.
What is it?
We're leaving in June.
We're finally doing it.
You're leaving in June?
Mm-hmm.
The baby's due in July.
Right. To Antwerp, City of Light.
Well, that's not... No, you're not.
No, we are. It's going to be superb.
No, and don't say that word.
We thought you'd be proud of us. We've been talking about this for 15 years, and now we can finally do it.
You're leaving a month before the baby's born? You're moving 3,000 miles away from your grandchild.
I think it's more than 3,000, isn't it, Cherry?
Oh, I think so.
The marvellous voices of Jeff Daniels and Catherine O'Hara. So the parents are going off and abandoning them. So consequently, they say, well, there's no reason for us to stay here. Let's go and go on a road trip and find the ideal place to bring up baby. And during the course of the movie, they visit friends and relatives, all of whom appear from the outside to have something resembling pretty successful lives, but all of whom, it turns out, have deep-seated and worrying problems and are... And, of course, I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that the further away they get from home, the more perhaps they realise a truth that is learnt by Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, which is that there's no place like home. Now, here's the important things to say. Firstly, I think it is true that your response to the movie may be defined by where you are in your life, meaning... I know a few people who've seen the movie and have very different responses, and it cuts down pretty evenly like this. If you've got a family and you've got kids, there are things in the movie that are very charming and very warm and very recognisable, and it's actually rather lovely to see a film about... See, the central idea is the central couple are actually fine. You know, normally during the course of this kind of story, what would happen is the central couple would have some kind of tension, which during the course of their journey would be, you know, would explode and would then be resolved. The story here, however, is that the central couple are perfectly fine. They love each other, and they carry on loving each other, and they still love each other, and that's how it works out. It's everyone else around them who appears to be sort of going quietly off the rails. So it is something which, if you have experience of long-term family life, and I think also if you have kids or if you've had experience of pregnancy, it is a slightly different movie. There are other people that I've spoken to who aren't in that position who have really taken against it. Said it was smug. I mean, when it played up at the Edinburgh Film Festival, it was very interesting just how much it divided like that. People who weren't in that particular situation said it was smug and didn't like the characters and it wasn't edgy enough and wasn't dark and wasn't any of those things. Now, I have to say, and I think there are things wrong with it, I rather took to it because it was something... there was something strangely relieving about seeing a film about a central relationship that actually works. There are some very funny moments in this. There's a fabulous moment when they go and visit Maggie Gyllenhaal, who it is Gyllenhaal rather than Gyllenhaal, isn't it? Because she's been on the programme and I always get the show. It is Gyllenhaal.
We asked her to clear it up once and for all.
And now we've forgotten.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
I think it's Gyllenhaal.
I think it's Gyllenhaal. Maggie,
now,
if you're listening, give us a ring.
Well, Nick has helpfully turned up slightly early this time just to make up for his lateness last time. And he's nodding for a J.
Gyllenhaal. And who plays this sort of, you know, ridiculously overbearing Earth Mother figure who believes that actually putting babies in buggies is a really terrible thing because it's strapping them down and doing... And there are many scenes that if you've gone through those experiences of other people telling you how to parent your child, other people telling you, will be very funny and very warm and strangely reassuring, and it give you a kind of nice kind of Horlicks feeling, you know, a feeling of sort of hot chocolate going through your veins and a feeling that in the end, all is well with what... And the reason I'm sort of... I'm saying it in this way is this, what I'm saying is different to saying it's a really good film. It's a film which there are elements in it that worked with me and worked with other people I know that I have, in more than any other film I can remember, seem to be specific to your experience of life. So what I'm saying is, if you are the middle-aged, you know, you'd like it, is what I mean, Simon. You'd like it, right? Jay-Z probably wouldn't get it.
Jay-Z
probably wouldn't get it.
Martin Jackson, BSc Honours in Agricultural Zoology, dear Blondie and Tucko, went to a preview screening of Away We Go earlier this week. It certainly passed the doctor's comedy test. I laughed fairly frequently.
Good.
The leads are engaging and carry the admittedly flimsy premise quite well.
Yeah.
Can't say the film broke any new ground.
Nope.
And it did become a tad predictable with the quirk factor set to 10.
No, but the
having said that...
Sorry.
The film is worth seeing for Alison Janney's laugh-out-loud performance as Veronica's old boss, Lily,
yep,
as far removed from her role as C.J. Craig in The West Wing as it's possible to get.
Yes, that is true. That is. There are many little comic vignettes. I think as a whole, it is structurally kind of, you know, it has a fallible structure, shall we say. And there are many things in it that if one was to be more rigorous, you could rightly take it to task for. But it did give me a warm feeling in a way that I can't think of, a comparable movie in the last year that has done so. But I do stress that I think that your warmth towards it will be defined to some extent by your own life experiences. And that, whether that's a good or a bad thing, I think is hard to say. It's not a good movie in those sense. It is a movie which, if you are a certain person, will give you warm feelings and will make you laugh.
Stephen Birmingham, dear S&M, being an avid Matrix fan, I've read Baudrillard's Simulacra and Simulation. I knew there'd be someone there. And it's the most difficult book I've ever tried to read. Funny that, given the title, you'd think it might. Of course, this may partly be the translation, but sentences go on for paragraphs, deviating numerous times and opening up countless literary doorways through Baudrillard can continue so that he can continue to explore his ideas. It's a philosophical treatise which reads like Ross Noble's stand-up.
Can I tell you one last thing about Away We Go?
Which is this? I thought you'd finished.
No, it's a very last point, which is this, because in a way this kind of sums it up. Sorry, Nick, it'll be very, very quick.
Don't apologise to him.
No need.
Apparently, and I'm quoting you, the film is the first studio production to adopt green filmmaking initiatives. Listen, this is great. Garbage was reduced by half thanks to the various bins for recyclable material, which obviously opens it up to jokes about recyclable material and garbage. Also, caterers use ceramic and washed dishes as opposed to throwaway products. So, in a way, it kind of sums up what it is about the film. It's a green film. It's a film which doesn't leave a load of garbage behind, which again, if you wanted to go, oh, you could do, but if you wanted to go, oh, well, you know, hey, that's nice, that's good.
Steve saying, dear Jennings and Derbyshire, before, they were great books, Jennings and Derbyshire. I loved those. Is it Anthony Buckeridge?
I never read them. I don't know what you're talking about.
Before old Wilco goes off like an old steam hammer, I think it's better to correct Derby's Latin and English vocab. The plural of octopus is octopuses. If it were a true Latin word, its singular would be octopes, and its plural, octopedes. As in centipedes. Oh, no, octopedes, as in centipedes.
Well, I would I would put a shout out, as I believe Jay-Z would have said, to whichever person with loads of letters after their name told us definitively last time we did this, and it was around the time of Old Boy, that the plural of octopus is octopodi.
Anyway, apparently not. So what we have coming up next is Cloudy with a Chance
of Meatballs. And hello to Jason Isaacs, we haven't done it yet.
And to David Morrissey, and to Fairport Convention, and to Stephen Fry, and to Martin Sheen, and to Nick Duncalf. Sean in Cardiff.
Yep.
So you're going to Hull. You've already been to Leeds and to Edinburgh. I'm sensing a northern bias here, and some of us are feeling left out. So I appeal to you, village person that I am, to go west. Come and see us in Cardiff, why don't you? We have a wonderful art house cinema called Chapter, and we need you here. We'll even throw in a Welsh cake or two, because just remember, Hull is other people, after all. So,
I believe it was Sartre who said that.
Was it? But he was just copying.
Hell is other people, I think.
He was probably just copying Baudrillard. Yes, we are going to Hull, and it's October the 20th. Hang on, October the 20th. I've got to do the corporate tart bit, OK? It's October the 23rd. It's the View Cinema, small independent thing. It's part of Five Live's Oktoberfest, and if you would like to go, assuming there are still tickets, bbc.co.uk/5live. You click on the Oktoberfest link on the homepage, because those tickets are going very, very fast. And it would be nice to see you in Hull on October the 23rd.
Sartre,
now you can interrupt.
Because he couldn't remember it, refused to believe that he had been born at one point, and his mother apparently replied that she had the stretch marks.
Luke O'Leary, dear doctor and doctor, I am a 20-year-old university student, and Away We Go gave me exactly the warm feeling that Mark was talking about.
Oh, well, there we go. In that case, I'm pleased about that, so it means that my what I said about it was completely wrong, but it has a wider audience than I expected.
Octopodes is the plural of octopus, according to Steve.
Octopodes?
Octopodes.
Any advance on octopodes?
That's all we've got for the moment. But we need to talk 3D, and there is an engaging film title to find out whether the film is as good.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is apparently based on a much-loved children's book, which I'm not familiar with. Are you?
No.
No, OK, fine. So if you are, great. If you're not, this is what you're going to get. And let's start by saying the 3D thing...
We know that. Take
Fine. I don't know whether it's playing in 3D and in 2D, but believe me, you don't need the 3D. I mean, the visuals are lovely and everything, but you don't need the 3D thing. Let's all boycott 3D. Let's all stay away from 3D.
No.
Let's make it so that when Avatar opens, everyone just says, "Not having it. Not having it." Sorry, James. Not having it.
Well, okay. Personally, I'm not going to join. That sounds like a really stupid boycott.
Okay, so the story is there's a very, very small island which lives largely on fish and sardines. And there's a young man who's an inventor on it who invents lots of different machines. And he invents a machine that can turn water into food. Okay? So he invents a machine that can turn water into food. The machine gets fired up into the clouds and it starts raining food. Hence... Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Along comes a weather reporter to report on the raining weather of food.
Here's weather monkey.
Weather monkey. I really don't think you can say that. Here's a clip.
Oh, my gosh. I am so sorry. Are you okay? I didn't...
It's okay. It's just pain.
Sorry, I'm not myself today. My whole career was ruined by some crazy jerk riding a homemade rocket. Wait a minute. What is going on with your feet?
Spray on shoes, they don't come off.
Cool! Ah! This could solve the untied shoes epidemic. What are they made of? Some kind of elastic biopolymer adhesive?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, wow, they're shiny. I'm Sam.
Oh! Flint.
Steve!
Is that a monkey thought translator?
Steve!
Incredible! Did you make all of this stuff? You hit me with a rocket!
You kicked me in the face!
I said I was sorry!
Monkey Thought Translator, or as it's also known. Now,
you're the movie monkey.
Yes, I am the movie monkey, and you would be the presenter monkey.
General monkey.
General monkey. Of all the clips that we had, that was the one that made the most sense, which I think tells you something about the film.
Didn't make any sense at all.
No, I'm sorry about that. There we go. The voice of Anna Faris there, and of course Bill Hader. Other voices in the film include the marvellous and aforementioned Bruce Campbell, who plays the mayor. Now, here's the interesting thing with Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, is I went into it with not particularly high expectations because I'm a little bit digimated out at the moment. Up is coming up quite soon, which I think there are good things about. I'm not sure that it's the masterpiece that everybody else thinks it is. You know, it played at the Cannes Film Festival. Everybody went completely nuts. And obviously, Pixar have been the brand leaders in this area for quite some time. I still think the high watermarks were achieved by Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2, which is pretty damn hard to
top. Soon to come out in 3D.
Yes, I know. Have you seen the trailer doing the 3D thing?
In which
all the characters come on and say, "Hey, now we're in 3D." And you just think, really? Because you were perfect before. It's like The Godfather. Do you think The Godfather suddenly going to Marlon Brando, "Yeah, you come to me in 2D on the day of my daughter's wedding."
What is that?
It's Marlon Brando.
This,
This repertoire is quite extraordinary.
No, okay, fine. So I didn't go in with particularly high hopes. And the funny thing about it was I actually really, really enjoy Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs for a very simple reason. It has a genuinely nuts premise and script, which is full of single one-liner strange surreal gags, not full of celebrity voices and completely naff knowing in movie jokes that are meant to nudge and wink at the parents while the kids laughing at the pizzas falling out of the sky. The whole tone of the movie is profoundly surreal, and profoundly surreal in a way which borders on being David Lynch. In fact, there is one moment in the movie in which a character who's dressed as a baby for reasons which are too complicated to explain is attacked by a whole series. You know what a chicken looks like when you put a chicken in the oven?
You know, it's a chicken.
No, but it's a trussed up chicken. You know, it doesn't look like a chicken. A chicken walking around doesn't look like an oven chicken, right? Okay, so imagine an oven.
In general.
So an oven chicken walking around, right? So there's a whole army of oven chickens which are attacking this central character who's dressed up as a baby. And the thing that it really reminded me of is that scene from Eraserhead when the guy goes round to his girlfriend's house and he gets served these tiny little chickens that suddenly start animating them. And it's really scary. It's really freaky. There's also a whole load of stuff up in the sky, up in the clouds, where there is this great big sort of strange pulsating orifice-like thing that is pumping out the food which is falling down out of the sky. And there is something really quite kind of Salvador Dali grotesque about it. Somebody sent an email in saying, you know, I was worried by the trailer because actually the thought of food falling out of the sky is fairly disturbing. You know, people swimming in rivers of milkshakes. It's like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which has a very kind of disturbing edge to it. It's like just that edge made into the whole movie. So although the story is completely bananas, ba-boom, I didn't even mean to do it. See how I did that? I didn't even set that up.
Just put
the food in.
Wasn't that great?
The level of surreal humour in it, and the speed and the wit and the sort of alacrity of it all, and the quality of the voiceovers. For example, getting somebody like Bruce Campbell rather than simply getting in somebody who was in let's get Val Kilmer in to do Prince of Egypt. You know, it's getting people in because they can actually do really good voiceovers.
Val Kilmer can do good voiceovers, though.
Where?
Well, he has good voices. In Tombstone, he was fantastic.
Yeah, he did, but that's not a voiceover. He was acting. And you know when you can see them on screen?
Oh, right.
That's acting. Voiceovers is when it's somebody else.
He can do great voices. Yeah. His Doc Holliday was fantastic.
Yeah, he was. A lot of his other stuff was rubbish. But so what I'm saying is, it's a genuinely surreal and beautifully kind of conjured, weird, odd, slightly gothic, strangely sensibilityed film, which I think kids will enjoy because there's lots of slapstick and lots of stuff going on.
Is it Tim Burton-esque?
No, it's... When I referred to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, what I was saying was there is on the one hand what you would think of as Burton-esque, but this is more Lynchian, although clearly there is a line of continuity between Tim Burton and David Lynch. So it's on that side of the creative divide. It is something which is anarchic, which has strangely 70s sensibility, which I assume has something to do with the original source material, is genuinely funny script, has plenty of laughs in it, goes zip-zang-boom, and then has moments of visual stuff on screen that are really, really quite breathtaking, and nothing to do with them being in 3D at all. So I was really impressed. I really enjoyed myself much more than I thought I was going to, and I would recommend it as a film that would work for kids and for adults, although I have to say for everybody there are things in it that are really that's creepy, that's strange. I mean, the thing with the bloke dressed up as a baby being attacked by the animated giant chickens who've escaped from Eraserhead is creepy.
Is it a use certificate or...
It's probably a PG, isn't it?
Stephen Solihull.
Might be you.
I saw Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, 3D, earlier. I was completely charmed by it.
Good.
It's not perfect, but its gags are funny. It's intelligent, self-aware, and warm. It has admirable morals, and the animation is glorious.
It's a use certificate.
It also, like so few family animations, understands that characters are more important than the celebrity cast voicing them.
There we go.
To the extent that I didn't spend my time guessing who the voices were. As for the 3D, it was an enjoyable sight, but I don't think the film would miss something without it. I also don't think Toy Story's 3D retooling will do much.
Can I just say that is absolutely right. That sums up exactly what I said. Apparently it is use certificate. Let me just point that out. Although that just use certificate doesn't mean that there aren't things in it that are genuinely quite creepy. And I mean, it may be that the older you get, the creepier you are. Maybe if your 7-year-old hasn't seen Eraserhead, which I hope they haven't.
Because they shouldn't have done.
Yes, exactly. Movie, they won't have that backing up.
Movie of the week.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
I think you're right.
I actually haven't seen any of the films that you're talking about.
Well, thanks for validating it in that way, then.
Yeah, based on your reviews, I can confirm that you're absolutely right.
Good.
Don't forget the podcast, which will be available very, very shortly. I hope you have a fantastic weekend. It's The Mighty Drive next, and we'll see you on Monday at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.